Today on Against the Grain, it's been likened to the Paris Commune, but took place a mere 41 years ago. In 1980, the people of Gwangju, South Korea, rose up against dictatorship, and for some precious days, the liberated city governed itself from below through mass assemblies. George Katsiafikas discusses the history of repression and rebellion in Korea, and the role that uprisings play in history. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Over the last century and a half, few peoples have been as militant as Koreans, resisting imperial occupation, war, dictatorship, and neoliberalism. And perhaps most striking of all 20th century Korean rebellions was the Gwangju Uprising of 1980. Radical scholar George Katsiafikas has documented the remarkable but short-lived liberation of the South Korean city of Gwangju in his two-volume Asia's Unknown Uprisings, which is published by PM Press. I should also disclose my connection to PM Press. Katsiafikas is a student of rebellions worldwide and joins me now. Well, today we're going to discuss the Gwangju Uprising. There's really no way to make sense of it without the larger context of resistance and social upheaval in Korea. Could you give us a brief overview of Korean society in the early 20th century under the Japanese Empire?
I think the best way to understand what happened in Korea is through the concept, the yin-yang symbol, which is so vital to Korean culture. For 1,500 years, there were only three dynasties in Korea. There were 15 or even more in China in the same period. So there was incredible stability, and Korea was known as the Hermit Kingdom. At the beginning of the 20th century, the population of Seoul was only 200,000, and only 12 cities had populations in excess of 15,000 people. It was a rural society dominated by landowners and aristocrats. And farmers were the way the society functioned. Everybody ate enough. They had repelled Japan in 1592, the Hideyoshi invasion, and enjoyed their independence. But at the end of the 19th century, Japan became the dominant military power in the region, defeating China. In fact, originally in Korea and around Korea, where they also, some years later, defeated the Russian fleet at Port Arthur. So as Japan came to dominate Korea, they signed a treaty with the United States guaranteeing Japanese control of Korea in exchange for recognition of U.S. control of the Philippines, and signed a similar treaty with Britain guaranteeing Britain's sovereignty of India and Japan of Korea. So with that in mind, Japan set out on a modernization program of Korea. They standardized the currency, consolidated taxation, built railroads, which of course were mainly used to ferry their troops deeper and deeper into China and to build their industry. They confiscated the best farmlands and made as much as one-third of Korea's population landless and homeless. Millions of people wandered the countryside, many settling in Siberia and Manchuria to get away from the Japanese domination. I mean, it's hard to overstate how difficult life was for Koreans once Korea was annexed by Japan. And Korean names and languages were banned. There was one policeman for every 1,000 Koreans. half of all the rice produced in Korea was exported to Japan, meaning the population was slowly starving. I mean, the consumption per capita of rice in 1940 was 55% of what it had been in 1912, when it was already meagered. Not only that, but I think we all know today that something like 100,000 Korean women were forced to become sexual slaves to the Japanese military during World War II. But as many as 7 million other Koreans were forced laborers in Japan. The United States counted 2.5 million in Japan, 2.5 million Koreans in Japan in 1945, and 2 million in Manchuria. So although the figures vary, it's safe to say millions of Koreans were basically compelled to do the bidding of the Japanese Empire. The sad fact is that despite massive resistance, the United States basically considered Korea to be very similar to Japan. It was, after all, annexed by Japan. But, for instance, beginning very early, right after Taft Katsura, a guerrilla war broke out. In 1909, Korean hero An Jung-gun assassinated Japanese Prince Ito, who was the resident general, the governor general of Korea. Next year Korea was annexed, but 9 years later, in 1919, on March 1st, there was something like a nonviolent Tet Offensive, where 33 prominent Koreans signed a declaration of independence, after which they turned themselves in to the Japanese authorities for arrest. More than 1 million people protested that day, and Japanese repression was lethal. By the end of May, that is March, April, May, in 3 months, at least 7,500 Koreans were killed and 47,000 arrested. Of course, that March 1st movement also set off the May 4th movement in China, which is historically very important for a Chinese independence movement. Within 5 years, a Korean Anarcho-Communist Federation formed in China. And in the next year, in 1925, a Korean Communist Party formed. By 1929, the self-government zone in Manchuria of the Korean Anarcho-Communist Federation involved hundreds of thousands of people, and also was an important place for refugees to find places to live in a system of mutual aid. As well, and I think this is very important for subsequent history, one of the best fighting units in the Chinese Communist Army, the 8th Route Army, was mainly comprised of Koreans. There were at least 145,000 Koreans who never lost a battle in their long war against the Japanese and against the Comprador Chiang Kai-shek regime.
Well, tell us then about how the events of World War II ended up deeply shifting the balance of power, and how did the Koreans react to those great power maneuvers that came out of World War II?
Well, it's safe to say Koreans were overwhelmingly joyous at the defeat of Japan, which, as we must remember, happened very suddenly, so that after Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the surrender of Japan, there were still Japanese troops in control of many parts of Asia, especially Korea and Vietnam. And those two places were divided among the great four powers. The Russians were given control, according to mutual agreements among the great powers, of northern Korea, and the U.S. of southern Korea, the Chinese of northern Vietnam, and the British of southern Vietnam. temporary lines were drawn. For instance, on a U.S. battleship, someone with a National Geographic map and a flashlight determined that Korea should be divided temporarily at the 38th parallel, since it ran right about through the middle of the country. And, you know, that was supposed to be a temporary measure after which elections should be held, unifying the country and determining who the government would be. But the United States knew that the overwhelming sentiment of Koreans was for independence from great powers. And to consolidate the control of a U.S. imported dictator, Syngman Rhee, who they brought from New Jersey, just as they had brought Diem to Vietnam, they sponsored elections only in the southern part of Korea, which had been, again, temporarily divided. Of course, the U.S. did this later in Vietnam as well. It had worked so well in Korea, where they sponsored elections just in southern Vietnam that got Diem elected. Korean resistance to these elections was nationally mobilized, but mainly on the southern island of Jeju was it a cause of an uprising against the American military government. On April 3rd, 1948, a few hundred guerrillas, mainly armed with sharpened bamboo sticks, attacked police stations in Jeju. It's important to understand Jeju citizens were part of a matrifocal culture in which councils of female divers who harvested the natural wealth of the sea surrounding this beautiful volcanic island. And the Japanese had been unable to conquer these female-led councils. They had basically, retained control of the seas and the diving, and determined, for instance, if another person could join in this part of the sea to dive, and who would be diving, and how the community would function. I mean, Jeju still has a slogan of no doors, no fences, no beggars, no thieves. It was a paradise, and in some ways still is. But very tragically, before the Korean War began officially, according to the United States in 1950, at least 30,000 people on the island of Jeju were killed under the auspices of the U.S. military government, of a population of only 300,000. Some people place the number at 70,000 killed. It was a massacre. It was horrendous. And the overwhelming sense I have in Jeju, since I've been there half a dozen or more times for research, but also just for kind of activism around the issue of trying to get a U.S. apology. I helped organize the only public event in the United States ever to address the massacre in Jeju, which was a Harvard University conference that received very little media attention, I should add. And the U.S. has never acknowledged its role in the Jeju massacre nor apologized, although the government of South Korea has apologized sincerely under different presidents and has tried to establish funds for helping the victims' families who remain impoverished in many cases. So resistance in South Korea to the elections being compelled to occur only in the southern part of the country was massive on the mainland as well. So much so that when the 14th Regiment of the South Korean Constabulary, which the U.S. had established, was ordered to go to Jeju They were issued new weapons and told to report on board ship the following morning. That night, the 14th Regiment rebelled, killed their officers, and took over a large part of southern South Korea in the Chola province, which is in the southwestern part of South Korea. This was in the eastern part of that province around the cities of Yeosu and Suncheon. And they basically said, we're going to reunify the country through military force. The United States mobilized all of its officers and all of its constabulary Korean troops, many of whom had fought for Japan in World War II, and were able to wipe out the guerrillas in Yeosu and Suncheon, and then track over the following few years, track the remnants who went up one of the high mountains in southern Korea, Mount Jiri. Jiri-san in Yeosun saw fighting that led to at least altogether 100,000 southern Koreans killed in fighting before the official start of the Korean War. This was all known to the Northerners. And so when the remnants of the 8th Route Army returned to Korea from China after the victory of the Chinese Revolution in 1949, they knew full well that an ongoing massacre in Jeju was underway, that the guerrillas in southern Korea were being hunted down and people massacred who supported the guerrillas. So that as the South Korean military, with U.S. encouragement, continually attacked along the border, the North Koreans prepared a small response, upon which the South Korean army panicked and fled south. I.F. Stone, you know, has written a book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, where he documents that the North Koreans didn't immediately invade South Korea or any such nonsense, if in fact Koreans invading their own country can be called an invasion. But the fact is that once the Korean War began, it became one of the bloodiest combats ever witnessed. More napalm was used than was used in all of World War II. Every single building, major building in North Korea, in Northern Korea, was destroyed. Much of South Korea was destroyed. The city of Seoul was taken three different times in the exchange between the Southern Army and the Northern Army. Douglas MacArthur, U.S. commanding general, who is often portrayed very proudly, never spent a night in Korea. He organized the largest flotilla to invade Incheon because the Northerners had conquered all through South Korea except for a perimeter around Busan in the southeastern corner of South Korea. With massive numbers of U.S. troops pushing up to the Chinese border, the Chinese military became involved, and again the line was pushed down below Seoul, then back up above Seoul. Then there was a temporary armistice signed in 1953, which continues to this day, although, for instance, one of the terms of the armistice, I could just mention one, that the United States, that neither party shall institute a boycott on the other. I mean, obviously, the United States boycott of North Korea is in violation of the terms of the armistice. And there are many others. In 1968, the American spy ship, the Pueblo, was captured in North Korean waters. And, you know, its entire crew apologized. And again, a violation of the armistice agreement. And there have been, for decades, there were daily overflights of U.S. nuclear-capable airplanes flying over Northern Korea, over even Pyongyang. So it's been really a continual state of war for North Korea for 71 years, since 1950.
Radical scholar George Katsiafikas is my guest. We're talking about his book, actually book in two volumes, Asia's Unknown Uprisings. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then after the Korean War, the U.S. continued having enormous influence over the fate of people in Korea. And I wonder if you could tell us about the post-war period leading up to 1980 when the Gwangju Uprising took place. Can you set the stage for those decades that followed the Korean War?
Yes. The Syngman Rhee regime was quite brutal, quite harsh. And in 1960, when rigged elections occurred, hundreds of thousands of students, some as young as elementary school and as old as graduate students in the universities, rose up to protest. And the response was brutal. Over 180 people were killed by the government. And massive demonstrations continued. The army sided with the protesters, and Rhee was forced to go to Hawaii in retirement, just as later we saw Ferdinand Marcos, we've seen the Shah of Iran, we've seen U.S.-imposed dictators continually flee in the face of popular movements. And the newly won democracy in South Korea lasted only about a year and a month. From April 19th, which is the date of the movement against Rhee, to May 16th, 1961, when a U.S.-backed general named Park Chung-hee seized power. Park Chung-hee had been an officer in the Japanese military, had a Japanese name, had been in the unit that had hunted in an attempt to kill Kim Il-sung, who became the first leader of North Korea. And Park ruled with an iron fist until 1979. During that period of time, he squeezed every penny he could out of the United States, even, you know, sending South Korean troops to Vietnam to fight there, where they were considered one of the most brutal forces by indigenous Vietnamese, in exchange for thousands of dollars per head from the United States. Although he did amass a fortune, he also developed the country. And, you know, something similar to what the Japanese had done in terms of industrialization for the sake of the large corporations, the chaebol. But his rule was authoritarian and dictatorial. And when an uprising in Pusan and Masan occurred in 1979, he sent in the army, leading to an inner conflict during which his own Korean Central Intelligence Agency chief assassinated him. Koreans were overjoyed. They believed that the time for democracy was at hand. But a new general took power, Chun Doo-hwan, again with U.S. approval, and told Koreans that stability would be the norm and anyone who protested in the streets would be severely punished. There had been massive demonstrations in Seoul, but when the announcement came that severe punishment would be given to anyone who remained in the streets, only in Gwangju did people continue to mobilize. And the response of the government was to pull paratroopers, the best trained troops in the South Korean military, off the front lines with North Korea, tell them that communists had taken over Gwangju, and send them massively into Gwangju, where they attacked the citizens as if they were North Korean communists. I mean, city buses were stopped, people pulled off, beaten. Women were cut with bayonets on their breasts and raped. Taxi drivers who stopped to help the wounded were themselves killed. The local police refused to help with the task of subduing the city. Many policemen took their uniforms off and joined the citizens in spontaneous protests. the violence is in some ways unspeakable. The military used flamethrowers on protesters. And after days of fighting in which dozens of people were killed, we will never know the full number. Many of the bodies were taken by helicopters out to sea or buried unceremoniously in garbage dumps. But after days of protest, it appeared that the struggle could not be won. I mean, citizens had burned down the local television station because it had misreported that, you know, there was a riot going on and that police were being attacked, and they burned the local tax office. They very scientifically chose targets to burn down. But the military just continued building up its forces. There were more than 40,000 crack troops fighting in a city. The local troops refused to fight, and their general was himself captured by paratroopers landing behind his command post. He was taken away and tortured. Cheng Ung, whom I interviewed later, he had run for Congress after the democracy was established and became a very popular man, but at the time he refused to join in the suppression of the populace in Gwangju. The police chief of the city of Gwangju was taken away to Seoul and tortured. So it was an uprising of the whole people, and it spread throughout the Cholas to all of the, you know, the whole province was cordoned off by the military. In the neighboring city of Mokpo, more than 1 million people marched in support of what was going on in Gwangju. But the military's force was powerful until a organized group of the city's transportation workers mobilized more than 100 intercity buses and taxis at the soccer stadium and drove them down the main street, Kumnamno, and directly attacked the military forces that were massed at the province hall. Something like 100,000 people fell in behind the convoy of buses and taxis. And through a night of heavy fighting, the military was compelled to withdraw. Basically, citizens had captured thousands of weapons. Some had been given to them by the police, who had opened their armories to the citizens. But also there were, you know, every South Korean male above the age of 18 had military service of some kind and was trained in how to use weapons. Those that were not trained received on-the-spot training, but there were plenty of weapons available. But what happened was heavy machine guns were captured by the insurgents and mounted on the Chenam National University Hospital, one of the tallest buildings in the city at the time. So the military at the province hall was not only having an attack launched on it by buses, by taxis, some of them burning and driven into their ranks, and guns, citizens with guns shooting at them, but also heavy machine guns shooting at them from this tall building. A military helicopter was shot down that had been strafing people who were fighting. So it was a full-on battle, and the citizens won. The military withdrew to the outskirts of the city. And for 1 week, fighting continued, but citizens mobilized rallies, direct democratic rallies, at the Democracy Plaza, it became known, outside of the province hall. There's a fountain in the middle of five roads coming together, and that fountain became a meeting place for citizens. And the daily rallies exceeded 150,000 one day, 100,000 on two other days. Tens of thousands of people discussed their differences and came to consensus on what to do. It was a remarkable thing, and all the while, fighting was going on.
George, you've made a parallel, although, of course, there are limits to the parallels that one can make in different places in different times, but a parallel between the Paris Commune of 1871 and the Gwangju uprising in Korea in 1980. And I wonder if you can talk about the similarities. Obviously, one is very well known, and the other, even though it's much more recent, is pretty much unknown, at least for many on the left outside of Korea, and even in Korea.
Yes. I think, you know, the comparison merits attention. In both cases, the city defeated standing armies and held their ground. Of course, the Paris Commune, for a longer period, for 2 months, from March 18th, with the roll of a drum, the existing National Guard took control of the city, and a few officers were killed who objected, a few of the generals. From below, the order was maintained. Criminal activity, you know, basically ceased to exist in Paris and in Gwangju. Mutual aid was the sort of norm that occurred. Artists became actively involved in both struggles. Hierarchy of everyday life was suspended. I think particularly in Paris, you know, the churches became community centers, and the priests were in some cases arrested, in some cases killed, but generally treated with hostility. In Gwangju, surprisingly to me, the YMCA became one of the centers of the protest movement, and the YWCA became the most radical meeting place in the city. But the Catholic churches, the Protestant churches, all mobilized against the military and had ongoing meetings that would converge at Democracy Plaza for the larger meetings. But remember, in the Paris Commune, there had been elections, and a government was elected. In Gwangju, there were no elections. It was direct democracy. There was no pre-existing army. People had spontaneously mobilized, armed themselves, and they formed a group called the Citizens Army, which had a structure to it, which had combat teams. You know, these teams formed. It's very interesting, Sasha, because people knew the military was coming, and most activists left the city. So there was a genuine vacuum of what had been the movement. And the few movement people who remained were able to be extraordinarily active in this popular movement that emerged. A theater group like the San Francisco Mime Troupe called Clown became the group that was the MC for the direct democratic rallies. And they, you know, anyone could speak, and everyone did speak. There were, as I say, some people said, this is crazy. What are we going to do? We're all going to be killed. We should surrender immediately. And other people said, no, you know, if we picked up guns to be nonviolent, to stop the violence, and the military government should apologize. They should tell us who is responsible and punish those who are responsible, and give us compensation for the people who have been killed, for their families, for the arrested. And the discussion went on. And finally, the consensus was continue to fight and to send truckloads of weapons to the military in exchange for prisoners, many of whom were being tortured. And indeed, many prisoners were released in exchange for the weapons. Weapons were plentiful in occupied Gwangju, not bullets. Ammunition was more scarce. And, you know, the next rally addressed the problem of the shortage of coffins in the city. And it was decided to send another truckload of weapons to the military in exchange for coffins. I think it's hard for us to imagine, though, the whole city mobilized. High school girls took the dead bodies and washed them and laid them out in a martial arts studio near Province Hall for families to come and identify their loved ones, because, you know, people didn't know where they were. The whole city was in turmoil. The use of money stopped. People took or were given what they wanted from stores. And many of the people I interviewed told me, however, you could only get one pack of cigarettes at a time, that people were conscious that, you know, the smokers had to share because there just wasn't enough to go around. Gasoline was rationed by the Citizens Army because there, you know, obviously not no gasoline, but there were open people's kitchens. Everyone had food. Farmers from neighboring, you know, the Chola region brought in fresh produce. Women textile workers brought in arms they had captured in Naju. The Hwasun coal miners brought in boxes of dynamite to be used. So it was, you know, a whole region rose up, and the United States had a meeting at the White House and decided it had to be suppressed. And they basically said to the South Korean dictator Chun Doo-hwan, let us send in an aircraft carrier to show support for you and in case North Korea tries to do anything, and then we want you to go in. And sure enough, on the morning of May 27th, the military with tanks and helicopters attacked Province Hall from the rear. You know, it was something remarkable because people knew there were announcements made by the military, helicopters, etc., dropped leaflets that, you know, this is it, tomorrow morning, anyone who resists will die. And yet hundreds of people stayed in the Province Hall. And they were all looking up Kumnamno Avenue. And instead, the military attacked from the rear and was able to take the building. And they spread the myth that no one was killed or three people were killed. In fact, dozens, possibly hundreds of people were killed on the morning of May 27th. But the citizens of Gwangju refused to submit. Even in prison, they threw chairs, they threw things at the guards. They sang songs, they kept their spirits up. You know, the military carted away the dead bodies in garbage trucks and dumped them far outside the city. And when the word spread that that's where the bodies were, immediately people began to protect the corpses, because they knew that the military would try to destroy the evidence of the massacre that had occurred. And for years, the military tried to even bribe the families of those who had been killed with large sums of money, and they refused to move the bodies. They even had sit-ins at the site at Mangwoldong, what is today a national shrine for democracy, because people fought to preserve the dead bodies for evidence of what had occurred. And, you know, South Korea for 15 years basically was kept in the dark. In fact, today there are still ongoing investigations of what occurred. It has now been proven that helicopters were shooting at citizens, for instance. But a wave of uprisings in Asia occurred from 1986 to 1992. 8 dictatorships were overthrown in 6 years in a region that has 5 different religions and 7 different languages. So it was truly an astonishing impact. By 1987, a nationwide uprising occurred in South Korea. Simultaneously, for 19 days, hundreds of thousands of people illegally went into the streets demanding direct presidential elections, release of prisoners, more democratic rights, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and they won some of those in 1987. Elections that occurred were rigged, and it took until the mid-90s for real democratic reform to take place at the highest levels of power.
George Katsiafikas is my guest. We're discussing the events leading up to the Gwangju uprising that took place in South Korea in 1980. George Katsiafikas is the author of the 2-volume Asia's Unknown Uprisings. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you mentioned that in the wake of the Gwangju uprising, there were uprisings that took place throughout Asia, and then including later in South Korea, which eventually led to democratization of the society. Popular uprisings are often derided as unleashing dangerous forces and often are not, therefore, properly studied. But you suggest that they are not only more significant, but they're more common than we tend to think. And I wanted to just talk to you about how do we see Kwangju in the context of thinking, which I know you've done a lot of, about uprisings as a sort of social force and not something that is simply an anomaly that takes place under particularly harsh circumstances in a particular, often distant place.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Sasha, that it's been something that I've thought about, researched, written about, and participated in as much as possible. In fact, since 1968, there have been waves of global uprisings that are basically not understood, not well formulated. For instance, the disarmament movement that occurred at the beginning of the 1980s, end of the 1970s, which was produced in part by these autonomous movements in Europe that made going into the streets for disarmament reasonable and possible, where the police powers in particularly Germany had been so strong. When the protest movement against American missiles took place and million people marched in New York City, in Paris, in Rome, in London, in Bonn, it was an event that led to tremendous changes in the world. Particularly, Gorbachev was convinced that Germany would not invade Russia again and that there was no need to keep the buffer states in Eastern Europe. So the subsequent wave of regime overthrows in Eastern Europe was a direct result of the disarmament movement. But also the Asian wave that I had mentioned had a great effect on Eastern Europeans. Václav Havel talked about the importance of the Chinese movement to the Czechoslovak movement. And many other observers talked about how events in Asia had influenced Eastern Europe events. Then, you know, very close following on the heels, the Zapatistas rose against neoliberalism in 1994, and the alter-globalization movement through Seattle in 1999, through February 15, 2003, when more than 30 million people took to the streets against a war that had not even started. And then by 2011, the Arab Spring, 14 countries, all of a sudden had movements for more democracy. The movement of the squares in Spain and Greece and Occupy Wall Street, which spread to thousands of cities. And of course, the uprising of 2020, Black Lives Matter, involved tens of millions of people without central organization calling for these protests. There were, you know, groups formed locally. One of the very interesting things about Black Lives Matter is that every chapter has autonomy and makes its own decisions. And of course, this leads to problems that, you know, the national leadership, though, has gone through a transition and is trying to take more responsibility for the, accounting of the tens of millions of dollars that were raised as a result of the popularity of the movement. But, you know, we've seen movements in Chile, in Hong Kong, in Lebanon, in Colombia, in Thailand, where for the first time the monarchy is being attacked, in Sudan and Algeria, where councils arose that were able to overturn longstanding dictatorships. So the image that leaders, world leaders, want to give is that men in suits, and a few women, of course, meeting in exotic places in Switzerland like Davos or in Idaho, that a select group of a few thousand leaders of corporations, of wealth, are able to make informed and decent decisions for the world. In fact, Those are the people destroying the world. Those are the people encouraging fossil fuel use. And those are the people who run capitalism, a system which we've seen, for instance, in Korea, incorporating non-capitalist regions brutally into a capitalist system that then destroys the environment, destroys lives, and produces booms and busts. That, you know, this is the problem. The solution are uprisings against these men at the top. This, you know, the Jeff Bezoses and the Richard Bransons and the, you know, the people with the billionaire class, the less than 1/1000th of 1% of the world that controls well over 40% of the wealth created by previous generations of labor and toil and blood.
Let me end with this question. So the philosopher Hegel finds his way into your writing fairly frequently. And I wanted to ask you, just keeping in mind the sort of dialectical dimension to this, you've talked about the way that the uprisings sort of spiraled out and led to other uprisings and led to other events. And we should not lose sight of that dimension. But you also write, and I quote here, "In the last centuries, every attempt to transform the world system has only strengthened it." Can you talk about this dialectic between what gets unleashed from below and then also how elites make use of uprisings?
Yes, this is an issue that requires a lot of thought on all of our parts. It's fair to say that the rich have never been richer than they are today. It's also fair to say that there are more people resolutely opposed to global capitalism than ever before in history. These are two products of the past decades of uprisings that we have witnessed. And what will be the outcome of this is uncertain. For instance, the United States government funded color revolutions in parts of Eastern Europe that remained, perceived enemies of the United States. Gene Sharp, for all of his nonviolence, used a former American officer in Vietnam who never apologized for his role in the killing of innocent civilians there as a front man to go, for instance, to Burma. On the Thai-Burmese border, I met Burmese fighters who had been in the presence of this man, Gene Sharp's colleague, who had preached to them about the power of nonviolence. These were people who had been gunned down in the streets by the Burmese military. So they've, you know, able to do that in parts of the world where there is more freedom to protest, as in, for instance, the protests against Milosevic in Serbia. But the elites have used the uprisings in South Korea, for instance, to spread the capitalist system even further. U.S. corporations have gone in during what the Koreans call the IMF crisis of 1997 and bought up Korean banks and corporations at bargain basement prices because of the crisis of the monetary system. So financial capital is a great form of manipulation of economies to the advantage of the very rich. And yet, as I say, there are more people in the world today resolutely opposed to global capitalism. Can we devise an alternative system that will disempower nation states, that will ban weapons of mass destruction so that governments cannot use them? These are steps. Can we disempower? You know, there is a trend in the United States, particularly today, where the Green New Deal and the attempt to revitalize the Democratic Party strengthens the system. I know the Republicans attack it. They think it's, you know, the worst thing that has ever happened. But from another perspective, it's as FDR, as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal propped up capitalism and helped it survive a depression and World War that threatened the existence of all these nation states. So I think this progressive element that has entered into the government of the United States will, in the short run, accomplish better things for many people, but in the long run will prop up a system that continues to exist with thousands of people dying every day in the world of starvation, with wars breaking out everywhere, with unjust governments being supported by the United States and even by Russia, by great powers. And I think people at the grassroots know that another world is possible. And yet we are continually barraged with propaganda that there is no alternative, when in fact we see it in uprisings, that in these uprisings the possibility of alternative societies and mutual aid is very real.
George Katsiafikas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sasha.
George Katsiafikas is the author of the 2-volume Asia's Unknown Uprisings. Today we've been discussing the Kwangjum Uprising, which is detailed in Volume 1. He's also the author of Global Imagination of 1968 and The Subversion of Politics, European Autonomous Social Movements, and the Decolonization of Everyday Life. And I should say that Asia's Unknown Uprisings is published by PM Press and disclosed my connection to PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.